for a bit. I'm just making a break there in the recording, so I have it partly for my reference, because I always look for a really positive, good way to end. But I find the ability to look at any situation from numerous perspectives with less ego, as little ego as we can muster, to just be a critical skill in this world. I think we need to teach it in all schools, but particularly in business school.
Yeah, I think, you know, look, we evolved for 300,000 years as sapien, you know, at the very least 70,000 years in our relatively, you know, current form, and for arguably 300,000 years total. And we got to this point with a mindset that was very tribal, very scarcity mindset, you know, oriented, you know, being able to survive was paramount. So concepts like, you know, spiritual awakening or achieving a level of feelings of connection between our consciousness and the world around us, these were not widely pursued ideas in the past. But now they're critical. These are critical ideas for where we're going as a species. And you're right. I mean, you know, what got us here is not going to get us there.
No, we need a new paradigm moving forward. I have no doubt about that. And I personally think part of the paradigm, we were talking earlier about AI. We have AI on one hand, which is moving forward, and it's probably more advanced than we actually realize. It has been around quite a 20 or 30 years now. It's just now coming into the public domain. And I think the yin and the yang of it is, again, human development. And human development, exactly as you said, is not something we have focused on. And we absolutely have to develop that emotional, spiritual, connected piece of the equation to balance out the technology that we're generating.
Yeah, it's funny when you think about all the great things we've invented, the technologies and the, you know, the ideas, all the things that we've done, you know, we've kind of been, again, focusing on the divinity out there, even the modern multinational corporation, which I believe to be the actual greatest invention that humans have ever come up with, because it's an idea that has created all the other inventions now, and all of the other progress all comes through the multinational. And that is a very efficient creation that we create as humans, but we haven't been as good about turning that lens inward and figuring out ways to improve the production machine, like the individual, the part of the cell in the body that's just its own function and capability, and how efficient it is at managing itself, and how much productivity can it create individually. Like, I think that we haven't been as good about bringing in the same way we're not very good about balancing the two hemispheres of the brain. We're also not very good about ensuring that our consciousness and the energy part of us is as productive as our intellectual brain part of us. The brain is like a cutting tool. It's good at understanding things and, you know, surgery. But actually there's a limitation to what the human mind can offer. The human mind is a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. And until we learn to dominate our minds using mindfulness techniques, then our minds are going to be dominating us. There's no static state. There's three things that are part of that concept. One is to understand that we're not our minds, and that needs to be accomplished before we even know what the heck I'm talking about, right? Otherwise, it just sounds ridiculous. What do you mean, your mind? You are your mind. No. Well, you have to look at the mind as the way you look at your heart or your arm, something that's a part of you, not you, right? We don't look at our hand and say that's us. We say that's a part of us. But we think of our mind differently somehow. We think we are our minds, and we think we are our thoughts and our emotions. And until you experience that you're not, that you will think so. So the first thing is you need to separate from the idea that we are our mind. And then second of all, once you come to that conclusion, then you need to focus on how do you balance out the mind with something that's even stronger, which is, you know, us. We're stronger than our minds. It's not even close, you know. Have you ever had a song in your head
that
in your head, right? And how, what do you do when you have that happen? Do you have a technique, or do you just kind of, does it just cancel by itself, or does it just not happen anymore because you meditate?
These days, if I got something stuck in my mind, it doesn't have to be a song. It can be an idea. It can be a concern. It can be anything. I have that ability now to stop, be still, and separate myself from it. I couldn't have done that 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And isn't that a wonderful skill to have, because it's so empowering?
Oh, it's amazing. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because, you know, just talking about multinational corporations and people and AI, I kind of think the multinational has hit the end of the pendulum in this particular swing of its evolution. And it's going to have to come back. And in coming back, I think we have to start recognizing the power of the individual and people as opposed to a collective large company. And I also think that the real power of the individual lies in our creativity. AI is not going to create the way we do. We have these wonderful minds that allow us to combine really disparate points of information and bring them together to a conclusion that is not logical, but may be very real. And I think that that's a real power that people have. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how, if as a culture and a society and a global community, if we can develop that more human spiritual side of ourselves, how can we integrate it with the systems that we know that work, with the AI, with technology? I wonder where that happy medium is. Right now, I feel like the medium's being pushed too far to the science end. I think it's got to be much more balanced.
I agree. I agree with you. And you know who else would agree with you is most of the successful people you hear about in Silicon Valley, the real thinkers that are out there, you know, not just running multi-billion dollar companies and portfolios, but also, you know, spending a lot of time on mindfulness and so forth. They would all agree with you. But, you know, I tend to find it useful to think of three power blocks in the world today, if you would, amongst humans, right? Separating from nations and vocations, but you've got three distinct entities, and they're all, I think, their own entities now. You've got corporations as an entity, a group of entities, and they, you know, by definition, they are amoral, which doesn't mean the same as immoral, but they're amoral. They're not focused on morality. They're also not focused on good or bad, but just what is enhancing for their own stakeholders specifically. And then it comes down to how do you define your stakeholders and how important are some of those other stakeholders besides shareholders in your, you know, in your, but that's one group. Then you have government, right? And that, you know, that if you think of them like circles, you know, those circles will enlarge or reduce in size over time. And then of course you've got people like as a group, right? Now in most places I see the corporation circle getting bigger and bigger, and the government circle getting bigger and bigger, and the people circle getting smaller and smaller. I don't think humans, in terms of like our relationship with those other two, you know, groups are increasing in importance, and power as a group. I think we're reducing, and more of that power is being transferred to other pieces. So this is actually how we as a species stay relevant, right? And it's by developing the creative side. It's by bringing in spirituality and mindfulness and you know, ideas about sort of one consciousness and all of those into our ability to be productive and to organize as a group. We need to stay relevant as a species because companies, we are not companies anymore. Companies are sort of their own thing. You know?
Oh, they're super national. And I think that I agree with you that that government and business are growing while the importance of the individual is shrinking. But that imbalance cannot last. And I think you're starting to see an emotional stirring. And I think emotion's very powerful because it's an intangible force that moves people to think differently, to act differently, to make differences in the world. And I think that's one of the things we're seeing now is this clash of disparity of powers and the human need to be a bigger part of our future.
Yeah, you know, like when you look at an issue that's affecting the future of everyone's, like climate change, when you realize is that we don't see our connection to the world around us clearly enough. Like nobody that you know is going to take a razor and start, you know, cutting their forearm just for fun, because they're connected to that and they know it's doing themselves harm. One of the nice things about some of the things we were talking about on this, you know, show is actually how much things like meditation and mindfulness exercises actually help us to see our connection to other things. And you start to realize, one starts to realize their consciousness isn't separate from this other person's consciousness. And so when we start to see ourselves in these other people, it makes empathy much easier to deal with. One doesn't have to be altruistic. One just has to be realistic to see the reality as it really is in order to know why it's so important to treat others the way we would want to be treated ourselves, or how one would not want to treat someone else in a way which we ourselves would hate. It's easier to be that kind of evolved human if we're practicing, you know, some of these empowering habits. Right.
Gary Zukav wrote several interesting books, one of which was The Seat of the Soul. And essentially, he really introduced me to the idea that all interactions are an exchange of energy, if you will. And it goes to what you're saying, that if you treat somebody well, that's an exchange of energy. And it's probably going to come back at you. If you treat somebody poorly, you lie, you cheat, that's an exchange of energy. It may not come back at you from that same person, kind of goes to karma, but somehow it does find you. And I think that the universe is very interactive in that regard. What we put out, we get back one way or the other. And that in turn goes to learning. What do we need to learn? And as we learn, hopefully we start to focus more on better and better outcomes for everybody. You know, on the climate change thing, I'm a little bit skeptical of some of the things going on because, you know, with a financial background, my thought is follow the money. The money always tells you what's going on. A number of years ago, I looked at a bunch of solar deals, none of them penciled without, you know, the government subsidies, and nobody tackled the issues of, you know, what do we do in terms of recycling? There's huge amounts of petroleum used in the windmills and everything else. It was not a really, it's not a clear-cut conversation. There's a lot of nuance to this, and I think that we're ignoring the nuance to our own detriment, and if you follow the money, a lot of these things are really driven by interests that are going to capitalize enormously on, I'm going to call it mass misperception. I think the Earth, the climate is changing. The climate has always been changing. I think there are two questions. How much of that is due to man? And I don't think we've even come close to quantifying that. Mm-hmm. And I think the other question, now, which is fleeting from my mind, give me one moment, on a changing climate, I guess I look at it a little differently. I spent about a decade and a half, you know, flying sailplanes. I could run down a ridge at 200 miles an hour. I mean, it's beyond amazing. So not only is the experience extraordinary, but it gave me an enormous reverence for Earth. And this was my second point. I think the second point in terms of so-called climate change that we have to look at is, I think it is essential for us to be good stewards of the Earth. And we are not being good stewards of the Earth. One of my pet peeves are appliances that break after 3 years and you replace them. They go into the landfill. Whatever happened to making appliances we could keep for 20 years and we could fix? I think there are a lot of really simple approaches to that are outside our current value system that would be enormously impactful in terms of our being good stewards of the Earth.
Yeah, I agree. There's really little for me to add to that.
The only thing I was going to say about that was it gave me a sense of awe and reverence for the Earth and an appreciation of how small we are.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I've tried to strengthen in my own life is my relationship with the natural world.
Yeah.
And also my relationship with the night sky. I tried to go back and look at all the things that, you know, if we evolve doing things a certain way, so like we evolved walking everywhere. So every human walked all the time because that was the primary way humans got around. And so I decided that, well, there must be really important aspects to maintaining that habit since we're used to that. And, you know, I try to get out once a week and see the night sky. I try to just go somewhere where I can see the sky. And I guess we used to have this relationship with the night sky. There's a lot about humans that we've lost and we've gotten very disconnected.
Yes.
From everything. And, you know, and if one looks at the world, not in terms of, you know, this is good, this is bad, or, you know, this is right, this is wrong, but more in terms of this is connection, this is disconnection. It actually helps explain quite a lot. When people are feeling more connected, they tend to not only tend to be happier, but they also, they're living in more of an objective reality, because the connection is the real, the reality of human existence, right? We live in this illusion of separateness. We live in this illusion of self, but actually, you know, seeing how we're connected is a success tool, and getting to the ability to feel. So I try to, as much as I can, connect into, you know, sort of the underlying software that we've all kind of evolved to have. But a lot of it, unfortunately, is now dormant because it's unused.
Yeah, I think there's a real movement, particularly among people also younger than me, to find that greater connection, to foster it. There's more of a group mentality in a millennial generation than there was in mine, which was more individualistic. I think it's really interesting to see how these things are evolving and what they may mean for us as a society as we move forward. Stay tuned. We will find out. What an interesting conversation. Thank you.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Pat. It's been great. By the way, I haven't even really told you the story of how my company almost died.
I'll segment it out because I'm sure it's a very good story.
That's a good one.
How did it happen?
So it was 2006, and we've been operating for a couple of years. Late 2006, we had around 100 hotels at the time. Almost all of those were franchised. And so we had this, you know, we had this nice cross section of different parts of the country represented, and we had a lot of momentum. A couple of the franchisees, you know, combined some legitimate complaints with a couple of complaints we thought were less so, and they organized a franchisee revolt. And so most of 2007 for us was trying to help the company avoid a fiery crash, you know, of a business that, you know, that I didn't, you know, really have a, I didn't really have a safety net, you know, so there was really nothing for me to go back on. So I had to, there's a great tenet within Sun Tzu's Art of War. He talks about how you must break the pots and burn the ships if you want to take a piece of land, because if you give people an exit, they'll never really summon up their true capabilities. And if they really just got to make it work, and humans are incredibly, you know, resourceful when put into that state. So we were in that state. And I knew that if we went into a direct battle with our franchisees, we were going to lose, but they weren't paying franchise fees at all. And there was a lot of press that they were placing the market, how we were being, bad actors. In fact, none of it was actually true. And only four franchisees ended up leaving the system at the end of all of this. We were able to preserve, all but three of the franchisees had signed on to this revolt, and they kind of were collectively bargaining for things that we couldn't offer them even if we wanted to, because we didn't own the brand. We were a master licensor, master licensee from the owner in the US of Super 8. And so we didn't really have a choice. Our ships were burned, and I had to think of a different way. And I got together with them, and I tried to find like common ground where I agreed with them. And I went through a process that was very much, you know, like contribution mindset. I said, you know, guys, I can tell you what I can't do, which is agree to what you want, but I can sit down and we can try to figure out how to get you what you're looking for, because obviously this brand doesn't work unless it works for everybody. And as a franchise brand, it really does fall to the franchisees to run the brand well, because they're the ones that represent the brand, and it's no way to do it otherwise. Unfortunately, though, zero sum thinking is often part of franchising, because it happens to fall that these are my obligations, these are yours, but again, like a cell in the body being both an individual but also a member of a group. You know, we chose to shift our mindset to look at our business with them as a partnership anyway. So I sat down with them over the course of several months, and again, we were really like down to no money, and I thought we were actually likely to fail. I'd already sent a letter to my shareholders saying, you know, this might not work, but I was trying to figure out a way to get them to come back without making concessions that we couldn't make, which was almost all the concessions they asked for, but at the same time, getting them excited about coming back. And we were able to look at what they wanted and why they wanted it. And then it actually did in the end help our business grow to 1,200 hotels. Like, we were only at 100 then. I doubt had we not forced ourselves or been forced to think of the business in a win-win positive sum outcome, you know, mindset, then we probably would have never grown past 400 or 500 hotels. Because again, you know, what got us to 100 was the mindset that we had. But clearly when we stopped looking at our franchisees as the problem, but as the messenger of a problem, and they were actually on our side trying to get to a better solution, then it took us out of the mindset that they're just trying to collectively bargain and get over on us when we're small, which maybe some of them were doing, but what they really, we chose to look at them as partners, and then they chose to react as partners as much as anything, because we treated them that way, even in a case where we were basically being, encouraged to talk with them sort of, involuntarily, but the result was still good. It was still the right result.
Were any of the major contracts renegotiated, or how did you find a solution to that?
Well, we did give them a couple of concessions on things that were just obviously, unfair to them. You know, when they were brought to our attention, we were going to do that anyway. But a lot of them, we kind of had to ask them to separate out their selfish needs from we kind of got them all back to the idea of, this is our brand, let's make it successful together. And our job is to do the part that you guys don't have to worry about, which is to, build a central reservation system and build a national reputation of high quality. And the things that we had to do from headquarters were now seen more as a partner effort, as opposed to us versus them. You know, we're the people that take the money, and they're the ones that do all the work. It came down to just sincerity and preparation, and time. You know, a lot of it was, I think, just listening, and like really listening to what they were saying, because, that's ultimately what they said they wanted was this whole raft of concessions from us. But what I think they really wanted was respect, and they wanted to be treated as partners. And they were right. And how we got to 1,200 hotels was by is by shifting our thinking that way. And you know, as a foreign brand in China, there's very little we can offer. And the ability to understand the local market, it's usually a great advantage, the greatest advantage of all. More important than whatever the foreign company can bring is the understanding of how to get things done in China, because it's such a unique place. But one of the things that you can do as a foreign brand is you can, you know, you can deliver Western ideas that are, you know, that are helpful, and, you know, and share those. And one of those was consistency. We were really into, you know, pursuing quality for its own sake, as opposed to necessarily just for what it could deliver, because quality as a value is something that we thought we could really, you know, inject into our processes. And we were very process oriented about how we delivered quality. And that was something that we had been having a hard time getting some of our franchisees to go along with, because it's easy to do things that sort of benefit one's own area, but not necessarily benefit the greater group. So one of the positive outcomes of this whole franchise revolt we experienced was we got much more buy-in for, you know, for the idea of following these processes that delivered consistency and quality.
That's a great story for business and for anything, you know?
Yeah. It really did make a difference. Again, my own personal development has mirrored my business development. And so obviously these ideas have also, have also been helpful to me, greatly helpful in helping me evolve as a person, to the point where, you know, it's possible to imagine, you know, futures that are very different from now, but I think are very compelling and far more based in concepts like connectivity and compassion and mindfulness. That's how humans are going to stay relevant in the world. You know, it's going to be more, as you said, you know, the pendulum is swinging back. It's going to be more about spirituality and things that help us to be strong, you know, holistically as human beings, that we can deliver, you know, value in the world, that we that's not just you know, siloed into my business value and my personal value, my friendship value, but, you know, we don't have personal lives and business lives. We just have lives. We think that they're separate, but that's an illusion. You know, everywhere you are, you're always the same human being out there. And so building the machine well, and to make it, you know, as productive and as you know, meaningful and able to make a contribution to others.
I call it concepts, building it from the inside out rather than the outside in.
Oh, I really like that. I might borrow that with attribution, if that's okay.
All yours. No, I think we're in for some interesting times. What's the old Chinese saying? May you live in interesting times.
Yeah, may you live in interesting times. Well, yeah, and actually, I figure we're probably in for interesting times, because that's what the stage of our evolution as a species requires of us, right? Because you're going to learn more in interesting times than in times that are less so. So it may not be fun in all cases, but I think I think they're going to be very meaningful. Like, I think it's actually quite a wonderful thing that we're here at this particular time in human history. I think it's an unusual coincidence, and I'd say something of a gift to be able to say that we might be in a time that humans haven't experienced in, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, which is like an actual species level shift potentially. I mean, you know, the fourth industrial revolution, I don't think people really understand exactly just how impactful it's going to be on our lives, because right now it just seems like it's all about 5G or there's this automated factory over here. But eventually buildings will talk to each other and to utilities and whatever. We're not going to be as involved in the operation of this structure that we've put together here, you know, how ships are going to be loaded and then travel to another place and then get unloaded and then get distributed. We're already at the point where a lot of that doesn't have to involve humans. And between the different technologies that we've developed and how advanced they've become, things like GPS and mobile technology and automation, those technologies just build on one another. Uber was like 8 different groundbreaking technologies that all had to be perfected in order for us to have Uber. But now we've got a new way of getting around that's quite efficient and created marketplaces for both customers, but also providers of the services. So it's what's called in Silicon Valley a double-sided marketplace. But all of that was built on different technologies that all had to be developed. Well, I think now the technologies that we're creating within 10 years, and capstoned by things like AI and synthetic biology, I mean, I think the change that's coming is going to be amazing. And we happen to be here for it. I mean, it's a time when you could actually reasonably think that the average lifespan of a human being could be extended to 120 or 150 years. People that are born today could very likely live to be 500 years old, right? Because the technology that's going to be coming out will help bridge over to a new time horizon, They've already discovered how to arrest or reverse something like 4 of the 6 cellular aspects of aging, and they're going to be solving great challenges very soon, right? With the different technologies that we have that can help us get there. So to be alive at this time and to be able to, watch this, it almost makes one wonder if this isn't a simulation.
Yeah, I think optimistically, we can look ahead to a future with greater longevity. And if we can manage in a very peaceful and thoughtful way to use AI to supply this infrastructure, this intellectual and physical infrastructure that we need, the maintenance, the connection between buildings, all these different things, it then frees people to be their human best, which goes right back to what we were talking about being more spiritually developed, finding greater peace and connection. That could be a very nice future.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a thought that a major consciousness shift,
yeah,
by humans could be accompanied by an entirely new golden age where we've kind of moved beyond the need for a lot of the things that we considered. Look, there have been many shifts in our species in the last, 4,000 or 5,000 years. Well, going back 11,000 years to agriculture and that then created the ability for us to create urban centers, and then that then led to the creation of civilization, which then led to the creation of ideas, and then technology has been evolving on a scale which seemed linear, but it's been exponential.
Yeah.
And now we're really at an exponential scale on technology development. But I mean, if you just look at the different shifts that we've gone through as a species already, it's not unusual to think that we may come to the time when human beings don't have to perform in any, regular tasks. That's what the fourth industrial revolution is here to apparently try to introduce. The idea is that things like transportation and building, structures and agriculture, a lot of this will be then automated. So what do humans do? We focus more on ideas and how do we, enhance our ability to, perform in ways that none of our creations can, including AI, which is, the ability to be creative. I don't want to be a species, chauvinist, but I'm pretty pro human, like Elon Musk, I guess, is always talking about how he's a sapien chauvinist. He likes the idea of human beings doing well. And I really do think that, we're at a time that, that we can experience things that, that perhaps no human, will ever have dreamed of doing, the ability to actually see a time where we, think in a fundamentally broader, wiser way. And that's an exciting thing to think about.
I like that thought. I'm going to end the recording because I think that's a really good point.